Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 265, recorded Thursday, September 8th, 2016, for Monday, September 19th, 2016. Tim Stevens. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/triangulation. And by Automatic, the small adapter that turns your clunker into a smart connected car. For more information on their brand new Automatic Pro adapter, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the limited time offer code TWIT for $20 off the new device. Welcome to Triangulation. I am Megan Maroney, filling in for Leo Laporte while he is on vacation. Triangulation is the show where Leo usually talks to some of the smartest people in technology today. Today, I am going to talk to one of the smartest and one of the nicest people in technology today. Tim Stevens is currently the editor-in-chief at CNET's Roadshow, which is not just part of CNET, but really its own destination, bringing perspective to the world of cars and automotive technology. Welcome, Tim Stevens.
Thank you, Megan. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I'd like to talk about all the latest in the world of cars, ride sharing, autonomous technology, what you've been driving, because according to your Facebook and Instagram, it seems like you're driving a different car every single day. Someone's dropping off these beautiful cars in your driveway.
Yeah. Driving my car, which is a weird, that's a weird first world problem for sure. But yes, I get to turn the keys into a lot of interesting machines for sure.
But first, I just wanted to start with where you came from. I learned a little bit from sleuthing the internet that your first computer was a Commodore 64, bought at Babbage's in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Set the scene for us a little bit.
Yeah, so I grew up in southern Vermont, and back in the 80s, there wasn't really much of a tech scene in Vermont, or really much of anywhere. So the closest shopping center was Holyoke, Massachusetts. We used to drive a couple hours down there on weekends and go shopping. And I remember Babbage's very fondly because they always had two TVs out front showing looped videos of all the latest video games. So I used to just kind of stand up from the store and watch that and obsess over that. So, yeah, one time my dad brought home a Commodore 64 for us. And, I started doing basic programming back then. Most of the time I was playing silly games and things, of course. But that was my first experience with programming way back in the day. Writing out these really incredibly long programs to make stupid animations. I remember spending all day typing one out that made the space shuttle go off. And it was the worst, terrible, most ugly graphics you can imagine. And it took me all day long, but I was pretty proud of that by the end of the day. So that was my first brush with computer programming as I was, you know, 8 or 10 or something like that.
Wow. So what were some of your other early experiences with computers? What came after the Commodore 64?
Really, the Commodore lasted a long time. That was around for a very long time. We didn't replace that with much of anything until a Packard Bell 486 when I was in high school. That was finally the replacement. It was a multimedia computer, which meant it had a CD-ROM drive and speakers, so that was pretty exciting. The most exciting part was the Doom shareware disk, of course, that came along with it. But that was, you know, the Commodore lasted a very long time, and then it wasn't until high school again that we moved up to something running Windows, a real operating system. And then after that, I actually got a job working at a custom computer store when I was in high school. So at that point, I started building my own PCs, and I've been kind of doing that ever since.
Wow, that's a good reminder that you don't need to upgrade every year. Like, I mean, we still need to upgrade more often than we used to, that we used to keep things around for a long time. It's too bad that we don't anymore. But I think we're actually moving more towards keeping our PCs around longer.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like to think that I still have that same first PC that I built, even though none of the components are still the same. You know, it's kind of like, is it Abe Lincoln's axe? I had the handle replaced and then had the blade replaced, but it's still his axe. Same kind of thing. I've replaced every single component in that computer, but I still think of it as the same computer I built for myself when I went out to college.
Really? You still have it?
I still have it. None of the components are still the same, but it's spiritually the same computer.
Wow. So was that, what machine did you first go online with?
Boy, it was that terrible Packard Bell, I think it was. And it was, what was ISP? Netcom, it was, back in the day. I think that was the first ISP that took me on the internet. And I turned into an IRC kitty like you wouldn't believe. That's how I learned to type, basically, was doing chat room stuff at 2 and 3 in the morning. I can type like 130 words per minute now, still thanks to spending way too much time in chat rooms when I should have been doing my homework.
Yeah, you. I read that you said IRC changed your life.
Yeah, I did. I have always had a stuttering problem, a real strong speech impediment. It was a lot harder for me as a kid than it is now, but it's still something that I struggle with. But in school, I really had a hard time. You know, we moved from Vermont to New York when I was in high school, and that was a really big change for me. And being someone who couldn't really reliably walk up to someone and say hello, even that was a pretty tough change. And so that was about the same time I started being able to go online. And so being able to speak with my fingers was kind of it was kind of magic for me. So I definitely made a lot of friends online that way, and that really helped to develop my personality, which is something I was definitely struggling with because, again, I couldn't really communicate very well when I was in school. That was a big challenge for me.
Now, I read that online, and it shocked me, and I'm sure it's going to shock a lot of people who are so used to how comfortable you are in front of a camera, your videos that you've been doing for a while. I mean, just comfortable explaining complicated topics. And it's usually things that you're passionate about. Do you think that that helps, that the things that you're talking about are things that you really love?
It definitely does, yeah. I mean, stuttering is a really hard thing to explain, or stammering. For me, it's a special kind called blocking, where basically you can speak normally and then you'll get to a word and suddenly you won't be able to say that word. And it's kind of hard to know which words are going to be problems. For me, it was always kind of soft vowels, so the word hello has always been a challenge. In fact, I almost got stuck saying it there. You sort of learn ways to dance around it, and I feel like I always have a tree in my head of other words I can say. So if I get stuck on a word, I can jump to another one. So I'm always thinking ahead like that. And if I ever had to read a script, I get in trouble because I can't dance around the words, that kind of thing. So being able to speak freely, and so that definitely ties back to being comfortable about what I'm talking about. If I'm ever put in a situation where I need to go on TV and talk about something that I'm maybe not as much of an expert as I should be, those interviews are always much more of a challenge than talking about autonomy or indeed Vermont or things like that.
So if you were to, say, run for president and then someone made you use a teleprompter, that would be difficult for you.
I would be in deep trouble. Yeah. If you've ever seen the King's Speech, that was the worst horror movie I've ever seen in my life. I saw that once and I will never see it again because that was a hard movie for me to watch because that's very much what I was going through.
Well, I hope you'll consider running for president because I think a lot of us would vote for you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Maybe is it too late to get in this year's election? Because I feel like there are a lot of people looking for a third candidate.
Well, we know you as a writer and a video host, but you talked about already about some programming that you did, and you have a computer science background. Talk a little bit about your background, your work in computer science, what you did there.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I got started programming when I was pretty young, and when I was getting out of high school, I loved to program, but I loved to write as well, fiction at the time, and I didn't really know which way I wanted to go, so I went to a liberal arts school where I could study both, and I did. And I was still having a hard time deciding which way I wanted to go as I was getting toward graduation. In fact, my kind of dream job was to go on the video game development side of things where I could do some creative writing as well as programming and kind of bring it all together. But I actually got some early opportunities to do some game development when I was still in college, and I kind of got a taste for the lifestyle of the video game developer and realized that that wasn't necessarily for me working 60, 80 hours a week for not a whole lot of money, and there's a lot of burnout, and it's a very difficult industry to get into. So, but I happened to be graduating at the time of the dot-com boom. It was year 2000 when everything was going crazy and everyone was investing in infrastructure, and so I very easily stepped into a very high-paying software consulting job, which made the decision pretty easy for me at the time to whether I should go on the writing side or on the programming side. So I went that way first. I still kept writing. I was already doing freelance game journalism, video game reviews, and that kind of thing. And so I kept doing that evenings and weekends and mornings. But my career at that point was a software engineer and then a software designer and then a software architect and then enterprise software architect. And then I just kind of worked my way up the chain and I really enjoyed it. But, the higher you get up the chain, the further you get away from the things that are, make you really passionate about it. So I wasn't doing coding anymore. And I kind of missed it. And I was spending more of my time dealing with corporate politics than actually creating software, which is what I loved. So I'd always been doing the freelance writing thing, and I had the opportunity to kind of start to shift over to do blogging more as a more serious thing, as a more serious source of income. And so I started to make that transition.
And Now, were you always passionate about cars? Because I know there's no question now that car news is tech news, but it wasn't necessarily always that way. Have you always been passionate about cars, or did it come from your interest in tech?
No, I've definitely been a car guy. You know, I can remember every computer I've had going way back, and I can remember every car that my parents have had and every car that I've ever wanted going all the way back too. So yeah, I've been a gearhead as long as I've been a tech guy as well. So those two passions have always been something that have been very important to me. But really, it was only, you know, in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, 8 years that, you know, that those two worlds kind of started to collide. You know, when I was a kid, the notion of being an automotive journalist wasn't even a career path that I ever considered. You know, it seemed like a dream job that only a few people in the world would be lucky enough to do. So I never really thought that I was on my way to getting there. But, you know, as these things sort of intersected, as cars became pieces of technology and very important pieces of technology, I started to try to blend the things together. When I was at Engadget, I pitched basically becoming the first automotive editor for Engadget. And sure enough, they accepted me at the time to be that. And that's where kind of things got pretty serious for me.
Yeah, I mean, you said you built your own PC. Were you also building your own cars at the same time?
No, actually, I do quite a bit of maintenance on my cars for sure. The usual stuff and brakes and suspension. And I just put new coilovers in my MR2, for example. So I do a lot of work in my cars. I've never gone so far as to build my own car. There are a lot of interesting kits out there that I'd love to play with sometime. But that's a pretty big commitment. You know, you can build a PC in 30 minutes if you know what you're doing. A kit car, that's a couple month obligation. So someday, maybe when I retire.
I assume you fix your own cars.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Oil changes, regular maintenance, upgrades, that kind of thing for sure.
Well, when we used to do the screensavers, that was the comparison that everybody made between Leo and Patrick as like the car guys, car talk. You know, when people would say like, what do you work on? It's like, I'm like, it's like car talk, but for computers. and it's interesting that as, you know, fewer and fewer people are really building their own PCs. I mean, it's just become just like a true hobbyists thing and just more of a niche market. But, I mean, the car guys are still really part of the tech world. I mean, just with autonomous cars and just all the technology in cars. When you started writing about cars, when you said you pitched it to Engadget, was it a hard sell, or were they like, oh, we were just waiting all the time to hear about this?
It was a hard sell. I'm trying to think what year this was. I think it was 2005, 2006, maybe, when I became the automotive editor. This was still a part-time thing for me, so I was still doing the software architecture on the side. But, you know, we were just starting to see things like sync. Nokia was just beginning to play around with what was terminal mode at the time, which would ultimately kind of evolve into the precursor for things like Android Auto and Apple's CarPlay. So it was just really beginning to set the foundation for a lot of what we see today when it comes to the integration of consumer technology into the automotive world. So it was still early days, but there was a lot of interesting things going on. You know, hybrids were becoming a big thing. EVs were right around the corner. Autonomy was still something that was down the road, but it was getting talked about more often. So there was definitely a lot of opportunity, and certainly there were a lot of aftermarket things for cars too, you know, Bluetooth adapters and GPS units. GPS, of course, was a big thing. And GPS probably, you know, those dash-mounted devices were probably one of the biggest things that really started to tie the two worlds together, because that was definitely a consumer device, but it was a consumer device intended only to run in your car. And so basically doing reviews of those alone was a pretty good way to sort of transition into the world of doing an automotive-focused review of a consumer electronics device. And that kind of began to tie the worlds together.
Well, part of what Leo does on this show is why it's called Triangulation is it's sort of a conversation between you and I and the chat room. So there's lots of people in the chat room asking questions. Ed is interested in how you got into cars and motorcycles.
That's a good question. I honestly am not sure. My dad is not really much of a car guy, but I still have fond memories of sitting down and watching the Indy 500 with my dad. But I talked to him later and he's like, yeah, I never really liked the race. I just sat down because you always liked the cars. So I guess I just sort of had this intrinsic love for cars and bikes. When I was a kid, I had, you know, my entire walls were covered by cutout pictures of motorcycles and cars and things like that. So I've just always loved cars and bikes. But the interesting thing was I didn't know how much of a passion my family had for motorcycles until I got my own. I finally got my bike license about 10 years ago and went out and got a motorcycle. And then it seemed like everybody in my family came out of the woodwork and say, oh, yeah, I had a Triumph. And oh, yeah, I had this. And I used to ride a Scout around in Vermont and so on and so forth. Like my entire family owned motorcycles. And somehow I never really knew about that until I got my own bike. So I don't know that I had a real strong influence there. It was just something that I always felt passionate about, even as a kid.
Maybe they didn't want to tell you. They were scared. Well, they were, you know, it's too late now to save him. He's already got it, so we might as well tell him.
That my mother basically told them to not tell me anything about motorcycles. But yeah, like my my uncle told me this story where he and my mom were actually riding on his Indian Scout, and the engine seized, and so the rear tire locked up immediately. And he said that he left a skid mark about a mile long down about the main road in our main town in Chester with my mom on the back because the engine had seized up on him. Tales like that I didn't learn about until after I got my own motorcycle.
I won't be letting my children listen to this for a while.
Fair enough. I don't.
Well, I want to get to your time at Engadget and afterwards. But first, I want to take a second to thank Audible. They're the sponsor of this episode. I have been using Audible almost a decade, probably since around 2008. And I listen to books. My kids listen to books. They listen to books when they're sleeping. They read books and then they listen to them again just because they missed some of the parts the first time. Audible.com is a leading provider of audiobooks across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. They offer language instruction and foreign language audiobooks. For listeners of Triangulation, Audible is now offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One you might consider downloading is Ready Player One, which is what I just finished. But have you read Ready Player One, Tim?
I haven't yet, no, but I definitely want to read it before the movie comes out.
Yes, it is. It's an excellent book, and I don't think Steven Spielberg is going to mess it up. He's been good to me so far. So to download the audiobook for free or another one of your choice, go to audible.com/triangulation. Okay, so how did you get your start at Engadget?
Oh, boy. I have to go back quite a while. I did freelance video game journalism for a long, long time. That was kind of how I paid my bills in college, actually, was writing about video game reviews, which is kind of the most awesome college job ever. and then, you know, as I got into software work, I was working very long hours, and so it was difficult. But I was trying to do at least one or two game reviews a month just to kind of keep in the cycle. And ultimately, that became hard to do because there weren't as many outlets as there were before, and the freelancing opportunities were kind of drying up. So I launched my own gaming blog. Called Digital Displacement, which is focused exclusively on racing games because I felt like that was kind of an underserved area of the market. And I figured if I'm going to launch my own blog, it should be on something that nobody else is doing well. So I did that for a while, and I got a little bit of recognition. It never did great, but it was good enough for me to keep doing it anyway. And then there was a site that AOL was launching called Switched, which was basically going to be more of a lifestyle-oriented version of Engadget. You know, Engadget's traditionally been the kind of hardcore tech blog thing. And Switch was going to be more of a general consumer audience version of that, basically. So they were looking to bring on some writers, and I sent them some examples of my stuff, and I was brought on board to do some blogging for Switch. And that was my first foray into professional consumer technology blogging, as it were. And again, that was a sister site to Engadget, and we did a lot of content sharing back and forth with Engadget, and we even went to CES with the Engadget team. And after about a year and a half doing Switch, I was given the opportunity kind of to switch up to the A-team, as it were, and to start doing the same sort of stuff with Engadget, which was, night and day difference in terms of the level of expectations and everything else and the readership and all that good stuff. So that was a big opportunity for me, and it was a really difficult transition because what they were expecting of us was a lot higher, but I soldiered on and was lucky enough to be accepted into the Engadget team eventually.
So this was your full-time job at this point. You weren't still coding.
No, it was still just a part-time thing. I would get up at about 5 a.m. and I'd do 2 or 3 hours of blogging in the morning. And then I would go to work and work 10 or 12-hour shifts doing software architecture. So it was, you know, really long days, but I felt pretty passionately about writing and about the opportunity that I wanted to keep that open. You know, it's to write for Engadget was a huge opportunity for me. And I wanted to do everything that I could to keep that. But on the same side, when you're getting paid per post, it's not really enough money to live on, especially if you're coming from a corporate professional job. It's a pretty big transition there. So I couldn't, you know, give my day job at that point. That it would still be some years down the road before I'd be able to make that transition.
So you're a little like John Grisham, the John Grisham of tech news, because he used to get up like at 5 a.m., write his novels, then go be a lawyer all day, and then he switched to writing about being a lawyer.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe at some point I'll start writing novels about tech blogging or something like that, which sounds like a really horrible idea. Never mind. But yeah, I just, you know, I really felt passionately that writing was a big part of, I've been writing in one form or another since I was a kid, and I wanted to make sure that I took every opportunity that I could. So it was worth the lack of sleep in the early mornings.
Well, you did say you used to write fiction, so I don't know. We've come up with some alternate careers for you. President of the United States, novelist.
Novelist is still the dream. That's where I want to get to someday. We'll see. Fingers crossed. All I get thus so far are rejections, though. So.
Oh, but you're writing.
I am writing, yep.
That's good. Well, do they know that you're the nicest guy in tech? Is that part of your cover letter?
I haven't gotten any rejections yet, so maybe that's inferred. I don't know.
Okay. So that world of, so what year was it that you really switched over to Engadget?
So when I switched over full-time, actually, to be honest with you, my first full-time job at Engadget was when I took over as editor-in-chief. I was still doing software consulting with a couple different firms part-time before I switched over. I was the automotive editor, which was basically half-time, and then I was doing about 20 to 30 hours a week of software consulting. So I was actually lucky enough to do a kind of a gradual transition as I went from one career to the other, which was many years in the making effectively, but it ultimately made that transition a lot easier than a lot of other people who make a very sudden break from one career to another. But really, when I took over as editor-in-chief of Engadget, which I think was 2008, that was the first time I was 100% full-time dedicated to Engadget and 100% full-time dedicated to writing for my first time, which was very nerve-wracking, but very exciting.
Well, as editor-in-chief, did you still do a lot of writing?
I tried to as much as I could. I didn't do as much as I'd wanted to. You know, when I took over, Darren Murph became my managing editor at the time, and he and I spent a lot of time planning about how we were going to be running Engadget at that point. You know, we basically ran the site together for a long time. And so he and I both had these grand plans that we were always going to keep writing content. Content was the most important thing. And we wouldn't let management get in the way of that. But ultimately, once we got the keys, I definitely didn't get to do as much writing as I wanted to. But I still did major reviews of things like the iPhone, the iPad, things like that. I did a few other features as much as I could. But certainly there wasn't a whole lot of time for that, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I reread your letter when you became editor-in-chief of Engadget, just trying to sort of assure everyone. Remind us, Joshua Topolsky, was he the editor before who left?
Right. That was a very tumultuous time, for sure. And there were a lot of people who were writing Engadget off as dead, basically, at that point. So Joshua Topolsky had been the editor-in-chief for about 2 years at that point. He'd taken over for Ryan Block. Ryan Block had run the site through a huge boon, but when Josh Topolsky took over, the site really blew up in a big, big way. And so a lot of people, when they think of Engadget, they think of that era when he was the editor-in-chief. And so suddenly I took over, and of course there was a lot of other people who were leaving the site as well as Josh was going off to form The Verge and taking a lot of the people who had been at Engadget at the time. That was definitely a very tumultuous period. Definitely a time when a lot of our long-term fans who had been reading Engadget for years were pretty concerned about the future of the site. So if I sound a little bit defensive in that introductory letter, that's why. And it also had to be a bit of an introduction because when I took over, I wasn't by any means the most senior person on staff. I'd been on the Engadget show a few times and certainly had written a lot of things, but I hadn't really been a face of the site by any means. But when I did take over, I was actually the only one on staff who had any management experience. And I think that was a big part of the reason of why I ultimately got the job, because I was one of the few people who actually knew how to run a team and run a team effectively. And that was one thing that I was able to bring over from my time as a software architect. You know, running teams of hundreds of developers was running a team of 15 editors. How hard can that be? Turns out it was actually pretty challenging, but it was pretty great, too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone, even whatever job you have far away from the tech field, everyone has that experience where people just seem to be pushed up into the ranks with no management experience at all. Yeah. And how lucky were they to find someone that had coding and tech experience and knowledge and was a great writer and had managing experience? So I think we're maybe not far away from that time period enough to really look back on it. But that time when there were just like people who were I'm going to write a blog and I'm going to start a tech blog. And then it turned into, you know, a big site like, you know, like Engadget or like The Verge. And then, you know, just in the past few years, we've gotten into this area where then they've gotten purchased by a giant corporation. And, you know, Topolsky's a good example because then, you know, he started The Verge, then he moved on from The Verge after they were purchased. And now he's starting his new thing that The Outline, I think it is. And so it just seems to be that he's moving, just wanting to remain independent. And that is, I don't know, what do you think about what it was like in 2007, 2008 versus what it's like now?
It's definitely a different world now. There were definitely more opportunities, I think, for smaller sites to compete than there are now. Definitely a big part of the game of success. Well, the only game of success really is advertising revenue. When you're running a site like that, if you can't deliver good advertising revenue, at that point, your sources of revenue are pretty limited. And at that point, you know, either it becomes a hobby or you shut down. Those are your options. And unless you are a big site with a big sales team right now, it's pretty difficult to really get compelling advertising and compelling sources of revenue effectively for your site. So it's getting harder and harder for smaller sites to compete against big sites like Engadget, owned by AOL, which is owned by Verizon, of course, now. And of course, The Verge as well. TechCrunch, you know, all these sites are now part of some larger corporate entity, you know, and of course, CNET certainly is part of that, being owned by CBS. So having that corporate parentage, it can definitely be a headache at times, but also gives a whole lot of benefit when it comes to the logistical challenges that are involved in running a site like this. But more importantly, the sales challenges of actually getting in front of advertisers and getting the deals that you need to keep everybody paid. So, you know, I think 8 years ago, it was easier to run a little site, to stick some ads on there and to blow up and make some money. Now it's pretty difficult to compete, I think, in those ways without having some kind of a big corporate partnership. So it is a bit difficult. But there are still, as ever, a lot of people who are willing to do this simply because they love it. They love writing. They love technology. And, you know, it's as easy as it ever was to form your own little blog and to break some big news and to ultimately take some traffic away from the bigger sites like a CNET, like an Engadget, that kind of thing. So that's still a threat for those sites. But when it comes to, you know, going big and actually making money off of this thing, it definitely helps to have some kind of corporate umbrella over your head.
If you look at Gawker as a different example, a different model of that. I mean, they weren't bought by a giant corporation, but they had, I mean, once they had a lot of money thing, you know, then they were able to be a target. They weren't able to do the same kind of journalism that they were doing before, whether you like it or not. How do you think Gawker has changed the tech blogging scene, just the disappearance of Gawker?
Yeah, it's definitely an unfortunate situation, of course. You know, the way that all played out was pretty difficult to watch. You know, I think people have a lot of opinions on whether or not what happened was the right thing. I will be honest, I'm going to bite my tongue on that one and kind of keep it in there to myself. But I think that both sides of the story there are equally right. I mean, what happened is a frightening example of the power of money in the U.S., but it's also, frightening. It's also, you know, proof that maybe you shouldn't poke the beehive sometimes. So I think there are definitely a lot of lessons to be learned here. But certainly if Gawker had a strong corporate parent going into that, you might say that on one hand, they might have been a little bit better positioned to defend themselves. On the other hand, they might not have been allowed to write that in the first place, which on one hand would have protected them, but it also in a lot of ways would have killed the site in an earlier way, in a different way. So the lack of Gawker is an unfortunate thing, but Gizmodo was always kind of the arch rival of Engadget, at least when I was there, and so I have mixed feelings about them, but certainly and I have a lot of friends over there and a lot of love for that team, and it is a shame the way things have gone down, and I really hope that Gizmodo and Jalopnik and all the other great sites have great success under their new corporate parents.
So what was that competition like back in the day between all of those independent sites?
It was pretty bitter at times, for sure. That was, I think, probably the one big change that I brought to the table was trying to be nice to everybody, and that's indeed why I got that moniker that is so often thrown my way. But before I took over, there was a legitimate strong beef between Engadget and Gawker. It was just, you know, it was known that we didn't hang out together, we didn't, you know, smile at each other at parties, at tech events, you know, that kind of thing. It just, there was legitimate anger between the two teams. And if one team got the exclusive that another one didn't get, it was like a personal insult, you know. And that never changed. You know, I'm a very competitive person when it comes to running these things. And if somebody else gets an exclusive, I'm probably not going to get a lot of sleep that night. But I was always the kind of person who would go up to that person who got the exclusive next time and shake their hand and say, congratulations, that was great. Versus, you know, my predecessors who would have been bad-mouthing them and maybe not being so polite about the situation. So that was the change that I tried to bring to the table, because it was really cutthroat in the, you know, in the mid-90s, the wars between TechCrunch and Engadget and Gawker and everybody else. They were pretty bitter, and there was a lot of anger and a lot of angst. And I did my damnedest to settle as much of that as I could.
And so what's it like now in that world when so many of the big companies own both of them? I mean, The Verge and Recode are owned by the same people, TechCrunch and Engadget are owned. I mean, what's it like now?
Well, the acquisition of TechCrunch and bringing them into the fold at AOL, that was not received well, because Michael Arrington at the time was still saying a lot of very negative things about Engadget. That was before I took over, so I wasn't really responsible for the messaging or the reception of that messaging at the time. But that was definitely something that was very negatively received at the team. And so that was one of the bridges that I had to build when I took over, was kind of, you know, going out to TechCrunch and making sure that everybody knew that I had no grudges against them, that kind of thing. These days, definitely, I think that a lot of that has been softened through one way or another. There simply isn't the angst that there was before. And because there are fewer players, I think ultimately, I think we're all kind of in the same boat together. And I think everyone realizes that much more so than in the past. So in general, from what I see, people are a little bit friendlier than they used to be. But then again, most of my time is spent these days working with automotive competitors. And frankly, that's a very different feel than the tech journalism. The automotive journalism world is much more inclusive and much more warm and friendly than tech journalism has been, at least traditionally.
Well, before we move on to BE or AE after Engadget, I want to have one more BE question. If you could go back to your Engadget self with your 2016 Tim Stevens self, what mm-hmm. what would you tell your Engadget self?
That's a tough one. Don't be so invested, I guess. You know, I took the opportunity to lead Engadget as a very, you know, very personal and very it was a big challenge. I knew it was going to be a big challenge, and I invested a lot of myself into it, probably too much. So I felt a lot of pride in the team, and frankly, eventually I developed some ownership of the brand. And as we shift from BE to AE shortly, I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more. But I realized very quickly that ultimately I had zero ownership, or whatever I had could be taken away very quickly. So that was a very rude lesson to learn in a very abrupt and painful way. So that would probably be my lesson. But, you know, ultimately, honestly, I wouldn't change a damn thing, because, you know, I'm incredibly happy and proud of where I am now. And all of that kind of led to me being here now today.
So you left Engadget. And what do you want to say? What do you want to say about that? I don't want to ask you anything you don't want to answer. You left Engadget.
I can talk about it. I mean, I don't think it's any secret. I was fired. The TechCrunch article that went up that very, basically before I had left the building, there was a TechCrunch article stating that, which you can maybe guess that'll give you some indication of, I think, the state of the corporation at the time, the fact that that news was leaked internally sideways to TechCrunch before I was even literally out of the building, which meant that people at TechCrunch knew that that was happening before even I knew it was happening. That was indicative of the situation in the corporation at that time.
Well, go ahead.
But that was a very very rough time for sure. But yeah, I was fired because of disagreements between myself and certain members of the executive team. And you know, I'd been struggling and doing everything I could to make sure that the editorial team was happy and had what they needed to do. And ultimately, I've been pushing back on a lot of initiatives and things that I didn't think were right for the brand for Engadget. And ultimately, we had a lot of disagreements, and that was the end of that. So, you know, it is what it is. And it was over 3 years ago now, which seems like a very long time indeed.
Yeah, I mean, you've been at CNET longer than you were at Engadget at this point.
Right. Yeah, it was about 2.5 years that I was the editor-in-chief of Engadget, something like that. And yeah, just hit my 3-year anniversary here at CNET the other day. So yeah, it's pretty great.
So what did you do between Engadget and CNET? It wasn't too long, but how did you spend your time between the two?
I was underneath my Toyota MR2 for about 2 weeks straight. I spent about 8 hours a day wrenching on that thing. That was That was great. That car is a real pain in the rear to work on. It's a very small car with very tight confines. Doing anything in that thing takes longer than it should, especially because mine is old and rusty. But yeah, I spent a lot of time getting a lot of bloody knuckles and doing a lot of work on that car that really wasn't necessary. But it was a great way to clear my mind from, you know, the 2.5 years of ADR weeks and stress and everything else that had come along with that, and to work on something that is you know, straightforward and kind of menial and tedious and difficult, but not really mentally taxing. That was a very good thing. So I worked on my car a lot. Took a week with my wife and went up to a cabin in the Adirondacks, which was great, with our pups, and did some hiking and kayaking. That was also awesome. And just kind of cleared my mind. And I was lucky enough to know that I had a lot of opportunities waiting for me, which is, you know, a very fortunate position to be in. The only decision I had to make was where I wanted to go. And I was very lucky.
That's nice. A little car therapy. Did you ever consider going back to coding, like going back to the professional world outside of journalism?
Yeah, I definitely did. I'd always kept those contacts open and available. And at the level that I was at, you know, if you're a low-level coder, things change very quickly. And so taking 2 or 3 years off would be pretty tough to get back in. But as an architect, you know, at that point, you're pretty abstracted. So I could have stepped back in, and I had a few opportunities to do so. But I was lucky enough to be talking to a lot of the top-shelf automotive outlets and technology outlets as well. So I knew that I had good opportunities to stick within journalism. And since writing had always been, you know, such a passion for me, and knowing that I loved cars as much as I did, and I had the opportunity to maybe really seriously write about them full time, that was a pretty exciting prospect, and that was pretty hard to pass up.
So now you live out in the middle of nowhere. When you were working at Engadget, and when you first started at CNET, were you already out there, or were you living in the city?
No, I've lived up in the middle of nowhere. I live not too far from Albany, New York, out in the country. And I've lived in that area for quite a while now. So, yeah, I was up there even with Engadget. At Engadget, though, I was coming down to the city probably twice a week. So I was on the train quite a bit. It's about a 2-hour train ride down. I still live up in the same general area, and I've lived up there for a long time now. I do get to the city less than I used to, but I travel a lot more than I used to, generally just to further places afield.
So when you started at CNET, were you editor at large? Was that your first job there?
Yeah, we went back and forth and trying to figure out what the heck the title should be. The basic idea was we knew that there was something automotive coming, but we didn't know exactly what it was going to be. So I knew I didn't want to give up tech journalism just yet. So we decided to go with editor at large because it was kind of a general term for writing things about stuff, you know, keep it flexible anyway. So we started with that, and you know, I did some reviews, I did some live blogs. At the time when I first came on board, I was focused on writing big deep dive features on how products came together. I felt like that was a big missing piece, something that I always wanted to do at Engadget, but of course never had the time to do so. So the kind of thing where I would go, for example, went to Nokia to see the anechoic chamber that they built to test all the Lumia devices that they were putting together, and all the hardcore testing that they were doing to make sure those were durable enough, and basically talked with all the engineers, all the designers, and put together what I thought was a really nice piece on how all that stuff came together and creating some phones that were more durable than anything else in the market at the time and far more distinctive from a styling standpoint than anything else at the time. So I did a bunch of features like that, which I was quite proud of. And I see a lot more of those now, which is great to see that more companies are putting the time in to create those things. But I did a few of those as the time went, and then really started to shift over to do more automotive stuff.
So you do a lot of video work. Which do you prefer, video or writing?
Writing, absolutely writing, without a doubt writing. I do video because it's something that you have to do these days. It's basically just part of the cost of entry, effectively. But yeah, for sure, I would much rather spend eight hours writing than 8 hours standing in front of a camera, even 2 hours standing in front of a camera. Yeah.
Well, that makes me appreciate your time today even more. So let's talk about Roadshow. your current gig is Roadshow. Who came up with that idea, and how long has it been in the making?
It's been in the making for a long time. So even before I came on board, there were conversations as I was discussing with the folks here at CNET about possibly coming on, about maybe wouldn't it be great to do something a little bit more upfront about cars, you know, to pull that out a little bit, to take all the great automotive content CNET's done over the years and put a bit more of a shine on it, I guess, and bring it to the fore, as it were. So this discussion has really happened even before I officially started at the company. But as things do, it took a while for everyone to get on the same page in terms of what we wanted, in terms of timing, and ultimately for me to decide that it was time for me to kind of shift away from consumer technology and really to embrace the automotive side of things. So those discussions were happening very early on. I definitely wrote up the proposals for the site and how it should be in the editorial voice. But there was a lot of direction that I got from everybody else here at CNET in terms of what would work, what wouldn't work, what they were looking for, you know, what would fit in the market. So it was definitely a big team effort here at CNET.
So what would you say is the mission of the site?
The site is definitely to cover cars in a holistic way, to not pull out the technology and to focus on that, or to not ignore the technology and focus on everything else. So the basic goal is to make sure that we're covering every aspect of modern transportation, whether it be, you know, some new innovation that gives a car more power, or some new advancement from Lyft when it comes to researching autonomous cars. To be able to cover that entire gamut in with the same level of detail without getting, too much buzzwords, or without kind of losing the message, but tie it all together in a package better than anybody else. And to bring that all together with buying advice, with research, and of course, great quality production video, and mix it all together into a package that's more comprehensive than anybody else out there. So that's always been the goal, to cover the entire modern transportation industry and to give really solid buying advice.
So what's your day-to-day like? Like I said earlier, it seems like someone is dropping a new luxury car off on your doorstep every morning. How does that work?
My average day is probably spent on a plane swearing at Gogo Wi-Fi, to be honest with you. That's probably the majority of my time spent these days. I'm lucky enough to go to the launches of a lot of cars. The automotive industry is a little bit different than the technology industry in that there's kind of the expectation that the editor-in-chief will get involved and will come along to some of the bigger events. So I definitely get, that gives me the opportunity to drive a lot of great cars. I do get cars brought to me to review as well, which is great. A typical loan on a car for review is usually about a week long. So to have a car dropped off on Tuesday and then picked up the next Tuesday is kind of a nice thing too. But I really don't have an average day. I mean, some days I'm in the field shooting a video. Last week I was driving a Lamborghini Aventador at excessive speeds of a runway. Last night I was on a red-eye flight here too, and I spent all my morning in meetings, and tomorrow I'll probably be buried in Gmail all day long, catching up on a lot of emails and writing proposals and sales pitches and things like that. So I don't really have a typical day, but it ranges from really cool stuff to other stuff that's maybe not.
Well, let's move on to autonomous car technology. Who are the biggest players in that field right now?
Well, it's really hard to say because so many companies are kind of keeping their cards close to their chest right now. We are seeing a lot of really exciting things from Google, of course. But the big question with Google is what exactly they're going to do with it. They don't want to build a car. They said that they don't want to build a car. It's unlikely that they're going to license that technology to manufacturers because everybody seems to be doing their own thing. So it seems like Google's probably going to go with a Waze sort of ride-sharing opportunity, which is exciting. But that doesn't necessarily mean that'll be a technology that consumers can necessarily access. So that makes it a little bit less exciting than someone like Volvo, for example, who will next year start selling cars that are fully autonomous in Sweden, which is pretty exciting. So when it comes to getting this technology to market, Volvo is definitely the leader because they're the only ones who are going to be selling fully autonomous cars and taking the liability for those cars too, which is pretty, pretty big and important. Volvo, of course, having such a huge safety background for them, this is their next big thing. For safety is autonomy.
So they're going to start selling them only in Sweden?
Yeah, it's going to be a pilot program in Sweden, in Gothenburg, in their home city. And those cars will only be fully autonomous on the highway, but they will be absolutely 100% fully autonomous. You'll be able to lean back, read a book, read a magazine. The cars will talk to the city. Any lane closures, any weather issues will be reported wirelessly to the car. So it'll be the full autonomous package, which is pretty exciting. And those will be the first ones available to consumers. Again, a limited kind of test program. But still, it's pretty exciting to see that coming to fruition finally. But other companies are not far behind. Audi's doing a lot of great testing. Ford's doing a ton of testing. Everybody's doing a ton of testing basically at this point. But Volvo, I think, will be the first to market.
And so do we have any idea how much that would cost? I mean, you say they're available to consumers to buy. Do we have any guesstimate as to what you'd pay for a fully autonomous car?
It'll be just a lease at first, actually. So they won't be able to keep the cars, much like the first EVs were only available on lease because it was basically an early test program and the manufacturers didn't really know what was going to happen to these cars after a couple of years back. Much the same thing here. But the really exciting thing about Volvo's technology, at least, is that it's based on the same sensors that are already in their cars. So in theory, they won't be any more expensive than a normal car. Really, the expense comes in the software and the testing. But as part of this pilot program, of course, these consumers will be helping to further along that testing. So I'm guessing they'll get a bit of a break on that side of things. But really, it shouldn't be that much more expensive. But again, that's just because this is only on the highway. When we get to the full-on A to B, wherever you want to go, autonomy with laser scanners and radar and everything else that you'll need, at that point, we're right now probably looking at an additional maybe $20,000 or $30,000 in sensors on cars. But those are getting smaller, those are getting cheaper, and hopefully, you know, in 5 years, those will be maybe adding on $5,000, something like that.
A lot of people in the chat room have asked what you are driving right now.
I live in the country, so I'm lucky to have a multi-car garage, so I can have a couple different machines. I have a Subaru STI. It's my daily driver. It's a 2012. I got one of the last hatchbacks in the U.S. before they switched to making only sedans, which I'm very glad I did. And also I still have that Toyota MR2. That was my car when I was in college. I bought that car 20 years ago in 1996, and I still have it. It's on its second engine now and new suspension, lots of other good stuff. So I have those are my two primary cars. I also have another Subaru that I use for ice racing, and I have a Yamaha R6 track bike and a Triumph motorcycle as well, a Speed Triple. I think that's my stable right now. I'm lucky to have a lot of vehicles, none of which are really worth all that much, though.
the ice racing, I posted on Facebook about how I just bought those life hammers, the things that you can knock the inside of the window out if your car ends up underwater. And I was happy to know that you also have one of those in your ice racing car.
I do, great for cutting seat belts, which is very important, especially if your car is sinking slowly. And then, yes, for punching out the window very quickly as well. Those are definitely a lifesaver. So if that is of any concern to any of you watching, they're very cheap on Amazon, Megan, as we found. Getting them mounted in the car is a bit of a challenge. They have little peel-off sticky things that don't work at all. So finding a good place for them is tough, but recommend them.
Yeah, that's the big question. What happens? How do you find it? Make sure it's reachable if you're stuck in the
If it's just, you know, sitting in the pouch in the door or something like that, there's a very good chance you're going to go flying out if you get into a crash. So it's got to be somewhere that you can reach and reach quickly. So, yeah, mounting it under your seat is a pretty good place to go.
And how do you get out of the ice?
If you're falling through the ice, that's actually a very difficult situation. It depends on how you go in the ice, of course. Most likely, if it goes nose first, you're probably going to have to climb out through the back window. And punching out the back windows would be a little bit more challenging because that glass won't shatter like the side window. But yeah, you'll probably just scamper pretty quickly and go out the back. But I'm very happy to say, I'm going to knock on some wood here, the club that I race with has been racing for, I think, 60 years now, and they've never had a car go through the ice. So I'm hoping that continues this season.
I think you're going to have to tell me what ice racing is. Is it racing on the ice? I imagined that it was like racing so fast you didn't fall through the ice, but I'm guessing that's not what it is.
No, it is basically like any other form of racing, except it's on a frozen lake. There's a bunch of different classes depending on what kind of car you have. Some are faster than others. I race in the street legal class. And basically, it's usually about 30 to 40 cars on a course that's plowed out on a lake. Usually the course is somewhere between a mile and a mile and a half long. It is a course with corners going left and right, so it's not just an oval. And we race a wheel-to-wheel in the winter. Usually it's from January till late February, early March, and we go around different lakes in the Adirondacks. So it's some beautiful lakes, very cold, and a hell of a lot of fun.
Ed in our chat room wants to know if you are holding a reservation for Tesla's Model 3.
I am not, but my wife is. So, yes, it's in the family, as it were. Yeah, she was asking me as that event was going on and I was covering it live whether or not she should get one, whether I thought she should. And I said, yeah, sure, what the hell, go for it. She did. And her parents actually reserved one as well. So there may be two Model 3s in the family at some point in the distant future when they actually start shipping.
I think I said, I'm not, but she is.
It'll be her car if we get one. We'll see.
Well, if you had to make a wild guess, what's Apple doing in the car space right now?
That's a tough one because I think, I'll be honest with you, I don't know that Apple knows what they're doing. And I don't mean that in a disparaging, in a bad way, like they're clueless. I think that they're still trying to figure out exactly what the market is. And I do think that they're finding it a lot more difficult than they thought they would. But that's something that we saw from Tesla as well. You know, Elon Musk comes from a software background. And as a software developer, you know, it's very easy to think that, you know, you can do anything with software. You can work magic with software, and so hardware can't be that much harder. Tesla had a lot of struggles early on, and I think Apple is going through those struggles as well. But of course, because they're so secretive, it's all happening behind closed doors. But if you look at the kind of employee churn that they're seeing there, it's clear that they're changing direction in some way. But so to get back to the question, what are they actually trying to do? I think that what they're working on now is some kind of a service. I don't think it's going to be a car available for you and I to purchase. I think it'll either be a ride-sharing service or it'll be something that they can provide to other manufacturers, like an Apple experience in the car, that kind of thing. And indeed, we may see both. It may be a situation where Apple releases the ultimate Apple edition Mercedes-Benz, for example, where you have Apple everything inside the car and everything's beautiful, and Johnny Ive comes out and tells you about the brushed aluminum and beveled edges of your new S-Class, that kind of thing. And then a couple years down the road, we have some kind of an Apple car-sharing service. I think that's what we'll see. I don't think they're going to be working on a car that will be competing. That I don't think we'll see Apple opening dealerships. I just don't see Apple really getting into that game, because that's a really big step from where they are right now. And for them to outsource the entire thing, you know, to the entire manufacturing of a car, you know, Tim Cook, of course, moved Apple out of manufacturing to shift them back into manufacturing for a car. That doesn't make sense to me either. So I think we'll see them building a service, maybe creating technology that's licensed or used by others, and maybe at some point launching a ride-sharing service. But I don't think that the quote-unquote iCar or Apple Car will be sitting in our driveways anytime soon.
Well, I'm going to make a wild guess and say that probably it will not have an auxiliary cable in it.
Probably no line in. No, it'll be Bluetooth or bust. Yes, absolutely.
Or lightning.
Maybe, or maybe they'll have wireless charging, which, you know, in that case, not having a charge port would be all right. But yeah, boy, headphone jacks. What a crazy controversy. Right?
Well, I want to get into electric cars and what's going on there, what all the latest there. But first, I want to thank Automatic, which is a great tool for your car. If you don't have a brand new fancy electric car, you can use Automatic to tell everything you want to know about your car. It's a small adapter that turns your clunker into a smart connected car. I use it in my car also. I would not call my Prius a clunker, but I use it. It's great. Automatic has just launched the Automatic Pro, their new unlimited 3G car adapter with no monthly fees or subscription. It's always there. So 3G lets you know where your vehicle is parked at any time, lets you track your vehicle even when you're not with it. It works with IFTTT for endless customization. You can basically get any sort of information delivered to you. You can monitor your entire life in your car, connect all of parts of your life, and you can easily file business expenses this way with popular apps like Concur and Expensify. You can even link your car to a Nest thermostat or your Amazon Echo. Just imagine it. You can ask Alexa, where did I park my car? You no longer have to remember anything. You can also get human help in a crash. Automatic Pro detects severe accidents, and trained responders call for help when you can't. Automatic works on nearly every car made after 1996. It takes just minutes to connect your car to your iPhone or Android device via Bluetooth Plus. Plus, it even integrates with Apple Watch and Pebble. Automatic Pro is normally $129.95, but when you use our exclusive offer code TWIT, you'll save $20. Visit automatic.com/TWIT for more information. And remember to use offer code TWIT to save $20 off the regular purchase price. That's automatic.com/TWIT, and we thank them for their support. I am here with Tim Stevens from CNET's Roadshow, and we're going to talk some about electric car technology. Now, what would you say to people who argue that electric cars aren't necessarily better depending on where their gas comes from? Or where their electricity comes from,
right.
How their electricity comes from.
Whether it comes from coal or from the sun, yeah, there's definitely a lot of truth to that argument. And certainly, it definitely depends where you are. If you're in the Pacific Northwest, for example, that has a lot of hydropower, your power is a lot cleaner than power here in New York City, for example. So it's very difficult, unfortunately, to find out exactly how clean your power is. But even so, even if your car is running on power that comes from burning coal or from nuclear or that kind of thing, there are a lot of ways of calculating that. Some calculations show that it's actually no worse than burning gasoline. Some show that it is a little bit worse. But ultimately, even if we do basically just shift the responsibility up the food chain, as it were, and move it up so that instead of burning gasoline, we're burning coal, that's simplifying the number of problems that we have to solve. Now, we've effectively removed emissions from cars. We've removed pollution from cars. Now we need to focus on removing that from our power plants, for example, rather than having all of our efforts spread all over the place trying to solve and make cars more efficient and power plants more efficient. Now we can just worry about having renewable energy And then once we crack that nut, we can go solve world peace or something like that. So I do think that even if there is not a a short-term benefit for pollution reduction, getting that shift and moving people forward into cars that are burning electricity and ultimately not producing any emissions, that is a step forward for us as a society, effectively. And ultimately, it's just, you know, it's just the more sensible way to make a car, you know, especially for, as someone who works on my cars, who has to worry about changing the oil in multiple cars and differential fluid and transmission fluid and drive timing belts and all that stuff. All those things go away in an EV. You know, I'm very excited for the time when I can have an EV as a daily driver, because I won't have to worry about oil changes. I won't have to worry about any of that maintenance. It's literally a car that I can plug in and charge up and forget about. And that alone right there is a huge reason to just step forward and not have to worry about any of that stuff anymore. Forget about the pollution and everything else.
Virgil in the chat room wants to know if mini fusion reactors are the answer to electric cars being more popular.
That's an interesting idea. I haven't seen any actual practical applications of any kind of a reactor that you could reasonably put in a car and not irradiate everybody who's in there as well, or have a car that is, you know, the size of a Mack truck. That sounds very potentially exciting for the future, but I don't think that we're there or we're going to be there anytime in the near future. Right now, the two main paths that we see when it comes to EVs, well, I guess there are technically three. One would be the traditional battery electric route, and the changes there are in the chemical composition of the batteries. Most right now are lithium ion, but there are other formulations of batteries that are coming along that may help maybe give us a 50% boost in terms of economy per weight, which would give us a lot more range for a given battery, which would be great. The next step might be supercapacitors. Supercapacitors are kind of exciting because they charge up almost instantaneously and they can hold a lot of power, but they're very big and clunky and kind of dangerous too, especially in a collision. So whether or not those come to pass, I don't know. There's not a whole lot of research going into supercapacitors right now. But the other main focus is hydrogen fuel cell cars. So these cars are also EVs. They also have batteries. And so they are effectively a battery electric car, but they have an onboard generator that generates electricity from hydrogen that you then pump into the car, usually at very high pressure. So there is a risk there of having to have those tanks very securely mounted in the car so that they don't go Hindenburg on you in a rear-end collision. But assuming that you can protect them, those cars are great because you can refuel them in a matter of minutes, just like a gasoline car. And they produce zero emissions. And the great thing is, as we progress along the path with battery electric cars, we are similarly progressing along basically the same path for these hydrogen cars, because again, they're using the same motors, the same basic inverters, the same basic technology. But again, instead of having a big old battery pack in the hydrogen cars, they have a hydrogen tank and an inverter effectively to generate electricity. So those are the two main paths, hydrogen powered cars and battery electric cars right now.
So the hydrogen powered car, is that the Mirai?
The Mirai, yep, that's a good example. And that's one car that's coming to production. And the Honda's got the FC Clarity as well, which is their version of a hydrogen-powered car. Volkswagen also is in a lot of research. In fact, I took a ride in a hydrogen-powered Volkswagen not too long ago, which was quite nice. And the cars are great. I mean, they have a little bit less power than your typical battery electric car because they can't produce the same voltage that a battery can. But ultimately, they ride very nicely, and being able to refuel them is nice. But there are dozens, maybe hundreds of potential refueling stations in the U.S. right now, way fewer than there are electric charging stations. And that's the big problem there.
Yeah, you were a great help to me as I was recently looking for a new car. And yeah, one of the many impractical choices I looked at was possibly getting a Mirai, which I would not be able to get to a charging station.
Unfortunately, there are no in-home hydrogen stations. The potential for hydrogen is really exciting for me because, in theory, once we can get cheap or free electricity, you can make hydrogen in your backyard effectively. Just pump some water in and have some sort of source of electricity, a solar cell, that kind of thing. And you can pump out hydrogen and you could, in theory, have a big old gas tank in your garage. You could fuel up your car at home for no money. That's pretty exciting stuff. And in theory, that would mean converting gas stations to hydrogen stations would be pretty easy, too. But again, that's contingent on us having a lot of cheap renewable electricity, which is another reason that we should stop having our cars burn gas because they'll need more electricity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were a great help to me offering many suggestions for electric cars. What are a couple of your favorite electric cars right now or something that might be coming this fall?
Well, we've got a couple of exciting cars on the very near horizon. The Model 3, of course, is very exciting, but I think that we're at least 12 months away from anybody having any hope of getting any of those cars, and more likely 18 to 24 months. So that car is, of course, a little bit hard to recommend at this point. The Chevy Bolt, B-O-L-T, not V-O-L-T, that is a very exciting car indeed. That's Chevy's $35-ish thousand-dollar four-door hatchback that seats five very comfortably, has a lot of room, and Chevy's promising over 200 miles of range. I've driven that car briefly, and it's very nice. I think that that's going to be a car that will open a lot of people's eyes to the potential of EVs. I think that's a really good choice. But the Kia, the Soul, is a great EV as well. That's in the market now. It's very low cost. It looks like a normal Kia, drives like a normal Kia, has no emissions, has a decent amount of range. That's a good choice, too. And then on the higher end, the new BMW i3 with more range is also a great choice. That's a little bit of a quirky car, not for everybody. The styling is a little bit out there. It's not the most practical of cars. But it's a pretty fun car to drive, and I think it's a great-looking car, too.
Yeah, I wanted that i3, but I didn't get it because I have a family of five. And I was looking at Roadshow this morning, and there's a great piece designed for people with families of five, cars for designed for people with families of five, which we're not always thought of. But so it has a good, that was a great review. I don't know if any of them were electric, but they were some. That's just one example of the many things that you see on Roadshow. Well, Tim, it has been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. And tell us, is there anything we missed? Anything about Roadshow that we haven't talked about?
Oh, man. Nothing coming to mind. No, I mean, it's really great to be building a new property and to be building a new team. I'm thrilled with all the people that I get to work with at Roadshow every day. The content we produce is amazing. I still say that one of the greatest perks of my job is getting to watch all the videos we produce before they go online for everybody else. I'm really proud of the stuff that we're producing. And so I'm really happy to be where I'm at. And very thankful for all of you out there watching and everybody who's kind of followed me on this weird, circuitous path that I've taken to where I am today. And Megan, I'm really honored to be interviewed by you and very thankful for your time as well.
Oh, thank you, Tim Stevens. Tim Stevens is editor-in-chief at CNET Roadshow and Tim Stevens on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on Triangulation.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And thanks to everyone in the chat room who asked questions. Sorry I didn't get to all of them. If you have more, I can pass them on to Tim. You can email me at megan@twit.tv. Leo will be back soon. Thanks for joining us on Triangulation. See you next week.